You are now listening to The Griot's Black Podcast Network, Black Culture Amplified.
Hello, it's Maisha Kai, lifestyle editor here at The Griot, and welcome to another episode of Writing Black, the podcast where we talk to Black creatives, Black writers, Black authors, Black thinkers, Black journalists, etc., about the incredible craft of writing. And this week we have someone who checks a few of those boxes, the award-winning journalist Ernest Owens, who just released The Case for Cancel Culture, How This Democratic Tool Works to Liberate Us All. This came out on February 21st. And I can't wait to get into this conversation because I think, you know, obviously, culturally, we are all very well attuned now to the idea of something or someone being canceled. But I don't know that we're always so clear on what that means. And Ernest, you do a really thorough job here of really illustrating not just what cancel culture is as we know it today, but the fact that it's always existed, correct?
Yeah, since the beginning of time. I go all the way back to the biblical days of Adam and Eve when Eve got canceled and, you know, the rest is history.
Eve did get canceled. Eve got canceled. They tried to cancel Jesus. It was a mess.
That's right.
It was a whole mess. You know, I'm always like fascinated by you know, historical studies. Cause I think like, you know, when you look at a book like this, you know, it seems like something that, you know, first of all, this is a great cover. I love the colors, love the whole thing. So shout out to your design team, at St. Martin's Press. But, you know, I'm also always really intrigued by the amount of research that goes into this. And because you are a journalist, in fact, I know you were the president of the Philadelphia chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists.
Well, we like to just go by the Philadelphia Association.
Oh, well, you know what? I like it.
Yes. We were the first, actually. We predate the National Association of Black Journalists.
Well, there you see, there's a history lesson in and of itself. And as journalists, obviously, we do a lot of research. We know, you know, everything must be fact-based. Everything must be backed up. We have to, you know, really go into the weeds with things. But in researching what cancel culture is, what it does, how it functions, like, where did you start with this and forming this thesis around cancel culture?
Such a great question. It really, for me, started with conversations. There were several like different instances and conversations where I thought everyone was on the same page about cancel culture until I realized they weren't. And it was a really big moment for me, which was in 2019, in October, when former President Barack Obama was having Obama Summit. He was in a conversation with Yara Shahidi, having a conversation about just life. And he goes into this tirade, basically bashing cancel culture and saying it's not activism. And it was just a lot of that going on. And I just thought he had a very boomer view about what cancel culture was. And I wrote a guest op-ed for the New York Times, basically criticizing Obama's take on it, because I argued that it seems to be this combination of a very group of a lot of young people that were very much so speaking out. And they were being chastised in a way that I felt missed the mark about what they were doing, that we saw older generations of people who were doing activism. And it just seemed like this group was now shaming younger voices. And so initially I looked at this as a generational divide between those who are much older and powerful, scolding the more progressive, young activist voices. That was my initial understanding. That has evolved through time, because what I recognize is that it's young people, older people, everyone in between disdain cancel culture. But what I found in my research and what I found just thinking about this more is that the root of what I was looking at when I thought about President Obama's critique compared to what my thought was, that this is really a power struggle. Cancel culture is a power dynamic. It's a struggle between those who have power, influence, and those who don't. And so as time began to progress and we got to the pandemic, I had a lot of time to think during the pandemic. And I started seeing more and more conversations about cancel culture. And I got to this point where I realized Dave Chappelle, Donald Trump, Joe Rogan, Obama, they all can agree about their disdain about cancel culture. They're coming from different industries, different political ideals, but they all across the board hate cancel culture. And then it hit me of, how come? How do they have this in common? And I said, okay, what is happening in cancel culture? Being held accountable. Who are these people? Billionaires, politicians, powerful people. Bingo. And then it hit me that people in power hate cancel culture because it's forcing them to hold themselves accountable.
Today, we have collectively found the tools to apply pressure to institutions and individuals who are used to getting away with being oppressive. Goodbye to the days of public figures simply saying and doing whatever they want without facing some level of public intervention. Cancel culture isn't only about canceling people and places, but also reminding the powerful that for every action, there is a reaction, and that they can't control the narrative or its outcome.
Took the word cancel culture out the conversation, and then we start to see what accountability looks like. And so really what it is that there's a bunch of people in power who have used the term cancel culture as a dog whistle to try to shame people in holding them accountable. And the book explores that. And how did we get here?
Yeah, I mean, and how did we get here indeed? I mean, I think a lot of people, when you think about cancel culture, you think very much about social media. I know you have a very strong social media presence and following, and I know that's where a lot of these conversations start.
Right.
But, you know, that's why I think the historical exploration is so intriguing here, because, you know, we think of this as one of those like hashtag phenomenons, right? You know, like something that's only been in our lives for the last 10 to 15 years.
Right.
But, you know, when we talk about what it really means to negate something and who's really in danger of being negated or suppressed or censored, mm-hmm. as it were, because, you know, you also make a really good case for the fact for being very clear that canceling something is not the same as censoring something. And I want to get a little right. deeper into that later. Because okay. I think that's a really important argument to make. Yeah. But, you know, one of the things that like I was really intrigued by the idea. I was like, so is everything cancel culture? is everything that we do whenever we say that we don't like something or whenever we organize around something, is that cancel culture? So, you know, I'm lobbing that back to you because I really think you are positing yourself as having really sat in this as an expert on this topic now.
Yeah, absolutely. So just a great question. And in the book, we definitely made those distinctions clear. For starters, you know, we need to separate the difference between critique of taste and boycotts in action, right? So let's talk about what cancel culture isn't, because I think that's a little bit easier. Or not. Cancel culture isn't food critics, movie critics, people who say they don't like someone for their own frivolous reasons. So if I said, you know, on this podcast, you know, I don't like this podcast because the audio quality is not as good. That's a matter of taste. It's frivolous. It doesn't impact your day-to-day livelihood. It's a matter of personal inconvenience. You say you don't like McDonald's because you don't think the food tastes good. That's fine. That's your opinion. It's harmless. It's a matter of taste. Movie critics who say a movie, we give a movie thumbs down because we think the acting wasn't good. It's fine. Cancel culture, in my definition, is when we decide to cancel a person, place, or thing that we feel is detrimental to our way of life.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. let's go back to this. I say, I don't like this podcast because it promotes sexist, misogynistic ideals that, you know, offends me as a woman that could stop my rights as a feminist or whatnot. Cancel culture. I don't like McDonald's because they don't give their workers a livable wage, hypothetically, cancel culture. These are the things that are presenting a larger, broader case. It can lead to boycott, divestment, policy change. It's something that is bigger than yourself. It's something that speaks to your morals, to your way of life, to your livelihood. In some cases, there are people who cancel for reasons that us personally may not, you know, agree with. But the mere act of counseling is a tool. It's not a policy position. It's not a conservative thing. It's not a Republican thing. It's not a Black thing. It's not a white thing. It is a tool. And what we choose to do with that tool leads to the next steps. So I look at cancel culture as a tool when you think about a knife. For me, that knife is to help me cut my steak, because steak is one of my favorite foods. I love steak. But it can be weaponized. It can be weaponized to harm people or do something detrimental. So people can weaponize cancel culture in ways that can be harmful for us personally. But at the end of the day, my definition expresses that this is a tool. And it is, for some people, this is their way to express themselves in a democratic and civil way.
Well, I want to get more into that and the good and the bad of cancel culture when we come right back.
It's subjective.
More. It's subjective. It is. With more, we're going to come back with more Writing Black and more Ernest Owens in just a second. All right, we are back with Writing Black and Ernest Owens and his new book, The Case for Cancel Culture. Now, if you hang out in Black Twitter for any, you know, length of time, you have gotten familiar with cancel culture, you may be familiar with Ernest Owens. He's got a pretty strong following. I highly suggest you follow him. It's always interesting. It's always thought-provoking. And whether or not you agree, it's always thought-provoking. And I think that that is always what the most interesting voices on social media are, right? They're not always just like the mouthpiece for your thoughts. They you know, compel you to think about things a little deeper. This book got me thinking a little bit deeper. I don't know. You know, it's so interesting being a member of the media and the role that we often play in, and it's tenuous. I don't actually like the media getting blamed for cancellations, as it were.
I agree. Mean,
we definitely participate in yeah, so far as, you know,
part of the First Amendment. So we
But I think it trivializes what legitimate media does to say, oh, you're just out here canceling folks arbitrarily. Legitimate media is a very fact-based thing. And, you know, we state the facts and we say this is what happened, right?
Journalism does.
That's what we do. You're right. Journalism and media are different things now too, aren't they?
I always say to people, all journalism is media, but not all media is journalism.
You are correct, sir. You are correct. But you know, one of the things that I thought was so interesting about this, you talk about two things here. Well, first of all, you use one of my favorite words throughout this book, and I think it's so important. It is one of my favorite words because it is one of my favorite reminders to people that everything requires nuance, right? Everything should be looked at through a nuanced lens. Every conversation has nuance. And that, as we like to say, there are levels to this.
Absolutely. And I think I said that in the book. I literally said there are levels to cancel.
Exactly. There are levels
to
this.
Absolutely.
And so when we talk about cancel culture, you know, one of the things I love that you just, you know, you made this analogy to the knife right before the break. And I think it's a perfect one, because when we talk about, you know, right, it's right up there. Cancel culture has now become like the word woke or political correctness or CRT or, you know, any number of things that on their face are thoughtful, you know, movements or thought processes or what have you, but have been flattened very much by a predominantly conservative argument against anything that compels us to think further, right? To think deeper. And you lay this out in the book in a really interesting way, where you talk about what it means when progressives cancel and what it means when conservatives cancel. And it's so interesting because you make the point that we as a society, part of our issue is that we live on this binary. So everything's so black or white. It's never like, you know, we're lacking the nuance. And I'd love for you to like dig into that a little bit for us, you know, for people who have not had a chance to engage with The Case for Cancel Culture yet. I would love for you to dig a little bit into the dangers of that binary and how it does kind of overlay this political lens, because people think of, you know, conservatives have done a very good job of branding cancel culture a progressive thing, but you very much, you know, kind of defeat that argument in this book. And I would love for you to talk about just the binary that kind of endangers us all, I think, at every level.
Yeah, absolutely. So in my book, both sides cancel. Everyone cancels. Let's just start there. All of us cancel.
Yes, we do.
It's our way of life. I mean, we don't know how to not cancel, actually. But I think specifically, what's unique about progressives versus conservatives is that progressives counsel with this utilitarian sense of for the greater good. They're very much invested in this idea of how do we support the masses, or how do we create a more equitable, inclusive society? Like, it's all about expanding opportunities and rights for.
We often vote that way too. We don't just cancel that way. We vote that way.
Yeah. And voting in that way is almost a similar type of situation. So that's important. Conservatives, however, you know, and let me back up a little bit before I get into what drives that. Progressives are driven by this sense of equality, human rights, and that sense of equity and quality shapes the way that they go about their pursuit. Conservatives are coming from a place of they're driven by their faith. They're driven by this idea of reclaiming society in certain ways that suits their privileges. The way that they go about cancellation is they're driven by patriotism. And I'm talking about this in an American concept, but this can be seen in Europe and other places around the world.
Yeah, there's a certain structure that they're afraid to have upended.
Right. They're traditionalists.
They're accustomed to, yeah.
They are traditionalists. They are really much not invested in dismantling rigid systems. They love the binaries. They love this. And they are fighting to maintain that. They don't want to expand it. They want to maintain what they feel is being taken from them. Mm-hmm. And that drives their cancel culture. But both sides cancel, absolutely. But the motives are different, and the way that they go about it is different, and what propels them is different. So, you know, when you hear former President George W. Bush used to say, you know, my faith, family, and friends, you know, he uses that, you know, those three Fs, that his faith is strong. He always talks about how he's a God-fearing man. He talks about family values. That's what is the idea basis of what drives the conservative movement within council culture. But progressives don't necessarily lean on that. There's acknowledgement, of course. There's many progressives who, of course, have faith in some type of capacity, but they're not using that to drive it. They actually use it as a way to acknowledge inclusion. They'll say, look, what I believe in you don't have to believe what I believe in, but we can be together. There's a different type of mindset about expansion. And some people are triggered by that expansion because they think that the expansion of certain views, such as, you know, LGBTQ rights, infringes upon their views on, you know, same gender marriage under God. And conservatives feel like this is an infringement.
Conservatives who argue that cancel culture is un-American ignore history altogether. It is literally the basis of our governing documents. The Constitution wouldn't exist without the defiance of colonists who resisted British tyranny.
They don't see that as liberty for them. But the irony within this is that I find the hypocrisies within conservatives when it comes to council culture, which is basically you want to be in this society where you talk a lot about freedom. You talk a lot about, you know, the Constitution and free speech, but a lot of what they do restricts those things for everybody. And so you have to ask the question, who is the freedom for? Who is the liberty for? And it's become very clear that it's become curtailed for the most privileged, powerful, whitest, straightest mm-hmm. people. And it's, you know, I wish I could say it wasn't that way, but that's what it is. That's what the research shows. That's what the historical record shows.
And that's where cancel culture can, of course, become a tool for the rest of us. And I want to get into that in a second. We will be right back with more Ernest Owens and more Writing Black. And we're back with more Writing Black. Do you have, you know, in the context of this argument about cancel culture, do you have any insights or advice or thoughts about how we combat it in a very, like, you know, this real world way that we're seeing right now, where, you know, we're seeing, again, a very strategic suppression of so many rights on so many different platforms. And it's happening everywhere from at the ballot box to on Black Twitter, where, you know, we're kind of being told to shut up or do it this way, or no, you can't do that, or, you know what I mean? And I think when we talk about democratic tools, like, all of those things are valid. So how do you suggest we combat that?
I think that for starters, is throughout our society, we go harder. We go harder in what we believe in. We've mm-hmm. done that forever. You know, I always tell people that council culture is ever evolving. There's no termination in some cases, right? Okay. You know, when we think about the 1950s, the world had a white perspective. America only allowed for the censorship, well, the speech of white men, white, straight, Anglo-Saxon Christian men. And they had control. Now we're seeing the powerful amongst that group try to do that again. What do we do back then? We mobilized. We pushed back. We took stances. We divested. We boycotted institutions and people that were complicit within those systems. And that made them rethink. And that's what we got to do again. If we see institutions that are completely just taking away our rights and pushing away our abilities to do what we need to do, we as a community have to come back and join forces and really mobilize collectively to say this isn't going to work. We either invest in something better or we divest until these other institutions get better. But we have the power to do that. And we have more resources and tools than our ancestors had. And so I think now more than ever, it's about a lot of us checking our privilege, because there's some of us in our community that aren't feeling this as the same as all of us are. Some of us are. And it's about not being selfish and recognizing that if it's oppressing someone in our community collectively or a subset of our community, it will eventually get on the other side. We need to be preventative and we need to be proactive. And I think that's what will help us avoid certain types of conflicts for sure. Mm-hmm.
And to be clear, when you talk about boycotting and divesting, just so that our listeners know, that is cancel culture. That is what Ernest is positing here. That is part of what cancel culture is. It's not all of it, but it's part of it. We're going to talk about more about that when we come back in just a second with more Ernest Owens. The case for cancel culture and more Writing Black. And we're back with more Writing Black and Ernest Owens and the case for cancel culture. This just came out on February 21st. And this is fascinating. This is a fascinating read for me. I really was, I read it quickly, which is always a good sign when I inhale a book. Because I really was, you know, now see, I didn't listen to it. I actually sat here and thumb pages, but yes, you can listen to it as well. You know, one of the reasons I brought up social media is because you have amassed, in addition to your own thesis that you develop here over the course of this book, you've amassed some of the most popular names that I know of on social media. Some really great thinkers. You got Preston Mitchum in here. You've got William Ketchum. You've got Leslie Mack. You know, there's some major names that I definitely know a lot of our listeners will recognize. And I love that you brought those voices in to support what you were saying, not just in terms of what cancel culture is, but really some of these historical moments that you are pinpointing. So I want to ask you a twofold question. Number one, you know, with cancel culture applying to so much of our history, how did you decide how you wanted to, like, what, you know, this is a craft question, you know, how did you pick out which moments you really wanted to highlight and that you felt were most pivotal in this argument? And then how did you go about recruiting this amazing roster to contribute to?
Yeah, they're the A team. That's the A team. Yes. And they're awesome. They're just great people. But the first question first. I wanted to do a mix. I wanted to do things that people definitely knew about so that I could be able to unpack it in a way that could break this down. Because if I went super, super niche or super, super unfamiliar, then I would have to explain. So we talk about Janet Jackson when she was canceled, right? That's a moment. We talk about the Dixie Chicks because some people forgot, or they're now the name is the Chicks. People forget about the Chicks and what happened to them. And so I had fun with that. But then I also had fun pulling out examples that maybe people didn't know in history, didn't consider, like Paul Robeson, you know, the incredible Black actor who really stood in his beliefs. And a lot of us who've been in the industry, people who study history and entertainment, we know about Paul Robeson, but a newer generation of Gen Zers may not. Right. So I really was big on taking some really great moments throughout, well, historical moments, because some of them were not great, right? But I love talking about Fannie Lou Hamer. I loved talking about all these different historical figures who were just great. And more people can read and explore them. So I did a combination of just some really great, what I would consider hidden figures and hidden moments, and then some really big popular moments to bring everyone in. I was so happy that I was able to get the baby, what happened to the baby in the book. Because at some point you got to stop. There's so many cancellations. Like, I didn't get to talk about Will Smith. Yeah. I didn't get to do what I would consider part two of the Kanye West conversation. We kind of stopped at the Trumpism with him.
But because I didn't take the misdiagnosis and I didn't take the medication, I'm able to speak to you guys clear of thought and transparently.
But we didn't get to get into, you know, everything else that's happened. But it's
listen, we're sitting right here. We can do it.
Okay, let's go, right? Like, there's that. But what I love that made this even better and what made the book better is that I was able to bring all these great people that are writers and critical thinkers and academics who have been doing work in various arenas in the industry to contextualize these moments. And it was dope. We had over a dozen people who was a part of it. And I was very intentional about making sure that my book was inclusive. We have non-binary people. We have queer people. We have trans people. We have feminists. We have activists. We have journalists. We have political consultants. We have Black Republicans.
I was about to say, you have conservatives in here. So I think it's very important people know that. Yeah, it's a well-balanced argument here.
Oh, we don't play over here. Like, my book wanted to have different voices because there's people that's like, oh, you have this progressive slant. And there is an arguably progressive slant. But at the same time, I do the work. I do my due diligence. I do go out my way to provide strong cases and bring people with those voices in those spaces. And I told them, I'm not here to judge you. I'm here to study you. I'm here to learn from you, which will make the book great for readers. But what was also wonderful was getting people who was a part of the action. So one of the co-founders of the hashtag #MuteRKelly movement is in my book.
Yes.
Annette Tisha Barnes. And that was a godsend.
We were intentional with Meet R. Kelly. Make no mistake about that. This was a direct targeted campaign against him.
When I first was going about recruiting people, I got connected to her on social media. I'd already known Leslie Mack, and she's awesome. And
yes,
I'm happy she's in the book. But the Kinette was powerful in the sense that I was like, I'm talking about your movement. I want to get it right. I want to explain to people that it's important that in these conversations that Black women in that space are noted in the book. You know, there are some people that would have gone for a little bit more famous names, but I was like, I was more intentional. It was about intentionality.
Yeah, what that movement did for not just his victims, but, you know, I think women at large, I mean, I'm a Black girl who grew up on the South Side of Chicago and still lives there. This is a very
I was born in Chicago.
So there you go. I love that you had her in the book. I want to get a little bit more into that. We're going to do that in just a moment when we come back with more Writing Black. We are back with more Writing Black and our very joyful, super fun guest, Ernest Owens, who is so passionate about this topic, the case for cancel culture, came out. This is so interesting to me that it came out during Black History Month.
Yes.
Black Twitter has definitely, you know, and I think Black people, you know, we are good at canceling somebody. We're good at, you know, we're also good at protecting people, which is interesting to me. You know, one of the things I love, so you have this, you have these little bites at the top of your chapters. And in one of the final chapters, it says, current arguments against cancel culture are driven by fear, misunderstanding, and sometimes an intentional mischaracterization of how power works. And it's that last part that really stuck out to me. I'm really big on people being willfully oblivious. I'm like, now, you know why we don't like them. Like, why are you, you know, we were just talking about R. Kelly. I'm like, come on now.
Exactly.
You know.
You still doing that?
Right, we're still doing that in 2020. But, you know, it's so interesting to me. And I love that you do it. You know, you talked about the hypocrisy of many, not all, but many conservatives in terms of how they use cancel culture. One of the things that, again, you know, I thought it was so interesting that your book would come out on the 21st of February, which we all know is Black History Month, because, of course, they're trying to cancel Black history right now. Right.
Yeah. It was intentional. All of this was intentional.
Like
various aspects. Every aspect of this book was so intentional. everything about it. And it was important to me that this book came out in February during Black mm-hmm. History Month. You know, mm-hmm. the book was ready. I want to say, I think advanced copies went out August.
Okay.
You know, I think initially, you know, I had the idea of dropping it during the midterms, shake the table. And then I said, well, that just makes it more in the political conversation. And this book is bigger than the political conversation. I mean, there are political outlets have reached out to me and I'm talking about the book, but they want to talk about it in the political context. But this is about our lives. This is about how we live. This is about our daily decisions. And I'm so happy to be on this podcast because we're talking about it as a lifestyle. Because it's in our life. And I think so many people want to isolate like it's a hot button political issue. And I'm like, no, it's that too. But it's also us as a people and as a community, especially as Black people, how we live our lives and how we make decisions.
And how we wield this particular tool as you're presenting it to us. How we wield it.
Absolutely. How we do it. And also, we've been doing it for our salvation forever.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things that really was striking to me is that in illustrating how we've been doing this forever, you know, when you have these, like, I always find that inane phrase, you know, I'm not my ancestor. I'm like, no, your ancestors were way more strategic about this. Like,
don't know why we do that. Don't know why people do that. Who told that lie?
Right.
They, you know, people say that. I say, you don't know your ancestors.
Right. Right.
You don't know them. You've let somebody tell you about them and you didn't know, because I definitely use family history to mm-hmm. also guide some of the chapter and some of the things I talk about. So the most powerful one, every chapter is powerful, but one chapter that really stands out to me is when canceling is the only option.
Mm-hmm.
And that's at the beginning. Because I wanted to lay down that with Black people specifically, they always make Black women difficult, Black queer people difficult. They always think that when we decide to cancel specifically, that we're impulsive, that we just decide to turn up. But what they don't know is all the microaggressions, all the cuts, all the slights, all the doors in our face before we decide to break that ceiling. Mm-hmm. And this book really explains that people forget, especially with Black women, like when they went forward and said, "Mute R. Kelly," it didn't just start with people ready to just boycott him. There were several conversations and soft pats and nods and references and reports.
And decades. That didn't work. Yes.
That didn't exactly. work. And so I hate when people say, why we had to do it like this? Why are we putting our business on Front Street? Because when we tried to put it and non-Front Street, when we try to put it in the room, in the house, and have the water cooler conversation, no one listened, no one cared.
Yeah.
And so that was really important for me writing this book, to acknowledge that this is a step-by-step. To your point earlier, there's levels to this. It's nuanced. Mm-hmm. And we forget that sometimes in these conversations.
I hope you are enjoying this conversation as much as I am. We'll be back in a minute with more Writing Black. All right, let's get back into it. Welcome back to Writing Black. Yeah, we do. I mean, you know, it's so interesting, even in, you know, again, on the levels, like one of the most recent conversations I saw, you know, we saw Chloe Bailey do a single with Chris Brown, right?
I feel like things are not the same. Now I feel away.
You know, after I saw her Instagram post days after this, I said, she gone, y'all. She gone. I said, she gone.
Know, it's so interesting because that, you know, I have such an interesting relationship to that story. I think, you know, I think, I thought it was really, I think it was really fascinating. But one of the things, the arguments that inevitably comes up is like, y'all still talking about this? Yeah, like that was da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, that was this long ago and blah, blah, blah. But then I think it comes back to your conversation about, what does accountability look like? So what should it look like, I guess, is my question. Like, what would accountability look like in a framework where we wouldn't be raising our eyebrows at that kind of collaboration? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I think, one, we have to be honest and do more reading. Okay. Let's start there. Let's read. There has been several instances outside of the 2009 incident with Chris mm-hmm. Brown. Chris Brown has been reportedly to have done other things. I mean, Karrueche Tran had a restraining order. Yeah. There was other instances of just erratic, violent, homophobic, colorist behavior from Chris Brown over the year. And so we need to acknowledge that reality. The second reality is that Chris Brown hasn't really been canceled in the way in which he's magnified it. There are some people who have definitely decided not to play his music. I don't really play Chris Brown music. If it comes on at a club or something, okay, but I'm not giving him any streams. I don't know the last time I've listened to a Chris Brown album since, oh my God, not no time soon. Maybe it's been a minute. It's been a while. And personally, that was my choice, right? I didn't care about all the other optics. But I think this is the difference between him and other people who have had similar issues. Chris Brown clearly is rewriting and doing revisionist history on his own. He's divorced himself from accountability. He's lying on his offenses. And that is the problem. So he said this incident happened when he was 17. No, Chris, he was actually 19. Let's just get the facts straight. Second of all, if it was just that incident, I think people would have forgave him if it was just that. Because look what happened. He went out on the BET Awards, Michael Jackson's passing. He cried. It was emotional. It was his redemption tour.
I mean, and Rihanna even uncanceled him. I mean,
she did. She did. And that's, you know, whatever, right? But in those regards, there was some sense of redemption there. Mm-hmm. But then you just saw year after year after year after year, more and more and more. And then it got to a sense that he felt like he had finished it, right? That he was on top of the world. He could be even more cocky and arrogant. And I think that that is what turned people off even more from him, is because there's been no sense of remorse, no correction of behavior. I mean, is he going to therapy? Is he doing any of the work to do anything to address his own behavior? And so that is why people don't trust him. See, when people decide to keep a person canceled, it's because there's a sense of you don't trust the person, you don't believe the person, you feel like the person's antagonizing in some kind of way. That's how I feel about Dave Chappelle. I can't listen to anything from Dave Chappelle at this point, because he's invested in continuing to double down on the insults, the cruelness, and the downright bigotry of his jokes. And I think that when you do things like that, you continuously create that type of problem. Same thing with Kanye West. It's consistent harm. And for people that say don't cancel him, maybe then if you don't want to cancel Kanye, how about you tell Kanye take a step back? How about we say, Kanye, okay, if you don't want to go into exile, how about you go to rehab? How about you reflect? Take a hiatus. We see a lot of people in Hollywood, when they mess up, they take a hiatus. I have a lot of respect for Will Smith. Mm-hmm. Will Smith is a perfect example of somebody who he did something wrong. Mm-hmm. He acknowledged it. He took some steps back. He didn't get super defensive. I love that man.
So cancel culture, as you say, I mean, as you're illustrating through your own words right now, cancel culture is not the end all be all. It is simply a call to accountability, and we are all welcome to be more accountable. And listen, as journalists who I know sometimes rely on hot takes, there are things that I wish I could. I'm like, oh, you know what? I think my perspective has changed on that. I do think I would go back and do that differently. So I don't know anybody who doesn't have that moment.
First of all, Black people are forgiving people.
Yes, we are.
Because we are so forgiving. So yes, when people act like we cancel people, like, we are forgiving people.
Yes.
I want to say, when I think about it, there has been exonerations in history. I talk about it towards the end of my book. Perceptions changing. Monica Lewinsky, one of the best examples of someone who was canceled in a country that did not understand the limits of power and sex and age and manipulation and coercion and all of those elements that happens, right?
You talk about Anita Hill and Blasey Ford. And
I love, you know, fun fact, I didn't think I added it in a book because I thought it was too salacious. My mother, I was born on October 12, 1991.
Okay.
During the Anita Hill hearings.
I'm not going to tell you how old I was in on that date, but okay. Well, I have a fun fact back for you, because one of the reasons the Chris Brown argument always intrigues me is that the night that incident happened was my first Grammys. Fun fact, though, because this is somebody else you bring up in the book multiple times, the person who beat me in my category was Chrisette Michele.
Wow.
And you talk about Chrisette's cancellation as well after she sang for Trump. So, you know, it's all connected, y'all. That's what we're saying.
That's a moment. And I bet you in your mind, you would have never thought years later, here we are, like over 14, 15 years later.
That's right.
And life is, wow.
Yeah, life is strange and circular. And
yes, so
cancel culture always comes back around, but it is a tool we should all be using. I think this is a book that everybody should get into.
I agree.
It's more fun than you think it's going to be. So don't let the idea of the tool, deter you guys from reading. The case for cancel culture is real. We can be using it more effectively. We're really glad you're with us today, Ernest, on Writing Black. This was big fun. I knew it would be. Follow Ernest on Twitter for more provocative ideas on pop culture, politics, and beyond, but also get into the case for cancel culture. Thank you so much for joining us on Writing Black this week.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited.
And we're back with more Writing Black. Well, this is the part of the show where I like to recommend what I've been reading, a little segment we like to call My Favorites. Ernest obviously has a passion for not just talking about this cultural phenomenon we know as cancel culture, but also the extensive history behind it. And it got me thinking about another amazing book by one of our former guests, Peniel E. Joseph, and The Third Reconstruction, America's Struggle for Racial Justice in the 21st Century. I really can't say enough amazing things about this book. I just think it's just so phenomenally written, and really much like Ernest's book, really frames out how everything old is new again. There's nothing new under the sun, whether it's cancel culture or, the politics that we're going through now. We are really at another precipice of another major turnover is what Peniel posits. And it's one that we can harness if we choose to, just as Ernest is positing that we can harness cancel culture for good or for evil. And either way, we should be looking at it as the tool that it is and being strategic about it. So that's my recommendation this week. Please join us next week for more Writing Black. Thanks so much for joining us for this week's episode of Writing Black. As always, you can find us on the Griot app or wherever you find your podcasts.
The Griot Black Podcast Network presents Dear Culture, Truish Black Stories.
When you think of sheer artistry, sheer creativity, the ability for someone to bring Black people together in the most fundamental ways, it's, I would say, of my four, Randy Watson's my number one.
When the news about Ricky first broke, what I heard about it is the thing you hear about, every time somebody Black dies, that it was gang related. That means the police don't know what happened. So they just said, probably the gangs, probably, the other Black dudes.
When I think of Akilah, I just think about how impressionable white people can be. I think about how, if you watch that movie again, if you should have lost like three times.
Where were you when you heard the story about them suckers getting served by Wade's dance crew?
It's crazy that you mentioned this. So as a New Yorker, right, everyone knows where they were on 9/11, right? A couple years later, right, 2003, everyone hears about this crazy moment in a boxing ring, because that's where dancers do get out, right? In boxing rings.
If you could say something to Ricky right now, what would you say to him?
Ricky, you shouldn't have never got that girl pregnant. You knew I had a crush on you. You should have got with me instead.
Moments in Black culture examined like never before. Join us as we dive into the Black moments that changed us, that changed the world. Make sure to subscribe to Dear Culture so you never miss an episode.